Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're looking towards the east, starting with
Well, actually, not exactly. It's more complicated than that.
Yeah, but this, we have so many good interviews coming up. I'm really excited about this. And I've always wanted to go to Macau. And wouldn't you know?
She didn't know where it was. She thought it was somewhere in the Midwest, somewhere near Chicago.
You're making fun of me.
And it's easy to be confused because our first guests have a restaurant in Chicago, but they love Macau, and their restaurant in Chicago is based on a Macau-style menu. And Macau is between China and Vietnam.
Okay, you're the geographer here.
There you go.
I know about the food traditions, which are luscious, and I love the title of the restaurant and the title of the dish, fat rice.
So why don't we find out all about fat rice?
Right. I've been enamored of Macau for ages and haven't got myself there yet. But I do have this book called The Adventures of Fat Rice. Arroz Gordo, right?
Arroz Gordo, named after that, for sure.
And we're talking to one of the owners, co-owner, Abraham Conlon. Let's just start at the beginning, because this book is going to be difficult to get across. It's so full, so many wonderful things. I love it, by the way. And I would like to eat all of this stuff.
send us a care package before we get to Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
We missed something here. And it's the geographer in me coming out again.
Well, that's my first question.
Because listeners, you need to know that Macau, M-A-C-A-U,
right,
is a tiny piece of Portuguese colonialism sitting on a corner right across from Hong Kong. It really ought to be part of China, unless you ask all the Macaus, because they'd rather be part of China. They'd rather be Portuguese. So that's the part of the world that we're talking about.
It's a little confusing, isn't it, Abraham?
A little bit, yes. A little bit. But we're going to explain that.
Yeah, but I was going to ask you to position Macau. Peter did it partially already. He did it geographically and partially historically. But you have a more in-depth explanation, although we want to give a brief description of how it came to be, Macau.
Absolutely. So Macau is a tiny little peninsula and a little set of islands that, like you said, is directly across from Hong Kong, kind of situated between essentially Vietnam and Taiwan. This little island, if you will, was a really important trading port about 500 years ago for the Portuguese and for many people and many cultures in South Asia. And, you know, when we talk about Macau and its food and its culture, and one of the things that drew me to it was essentially kind of the culmination of all of the other cultures that the Portuguese encountered prior to going to Macau.
Yeah, see, I like that part, that bit. I mean, it's okay to say, because, I mean, I do this when I'm trying to explain Sicily to people, how it's a corridor country and so forth. But I thought it was brilliant that you presented the very valid idea that actually by the time the Portuguese got to Macau, they had already exchanged all kinds of cultural and culinary ideas and influences with all these other countries that they had colonized. That's important.
Absolutely. You know, we look to kind of, again, to understand the cuisine of Macau, you kind of have to understand a little bit of history. In 1494, that's kind of when the two major naval powers, Portugal and Spain, they bisected the world, essentially, from east of the Cape Verdean Islands, west of the Cape Verdean Islands, basically would belong to Portugal, and everything west of that and even a little bit beyond Brazil would quote-unquote belong to Spain. And so there was this exchange, essentially, of ideas and cultures and products and things from, you know, New World ingredients from Brazil that made their way back to Portugal, various products and resources from Africa to India, all the way along through Southeast Asia to Malaysia, and even upwards to Japan. You know, the Portuguese were in Japan before they even got to Macau. They wanted to be on land. They saw it as a great trading port and as a central location. They weren't really allowed to land until essentially the Chinese government saw that they were valuable in being a liaison of trade between China and Japan, which they weren't necessarily allowed to trade with each other. So they utilized the Portuguese as basically a liaison between the two for them to exchange goods.
Now, let's just jump, though, at this point, to the point of there's you, Abraham Conlon, and your partner, Adrienne Lowe, and you're kind of a miniature Macau yourselves, aren't you?
A little bit of a miniature Macau in ourselves, yes, for me. And I became most interested in Macau and Macanese cuisine in 1999 when I read a magazine article by Margaret Sheridan and about it was titled Original Fusion. And for me, I grew up in a town, Lowell, Massachusetts, Portuguese American family. But Lowell, Massachusetts was considered an all American city, and what that means is just a variety of cultures existing in one space. And, you know, we had a very large Southeast Asian population, mostly Laotian, Cambodian, Thai, Vietnamese. And I became very enamored with kind of the cuisine and the ingredients from those different cultures. And, you know, as a young cook, I started, you know, wanting to see those in the food that I was doing. And I was fortunate enough to work for some great chefs that were actually doing that. And then when I read in 1999 about Macau and that there was this place and there was this culture that was a combined culture of Portuguese, Chinese, that incorporated flavors and ingredients and techniques from Southeast Asia and India. These were all things that I was really interested in. And
Adrienne, though, is Chinese.
Absolutely. So I kind of forgot about the magazine article. And then 10 years or so later, I met Adrienne Lowe, and yes, she's half Chinese, and very food forward family, and we took a trip all together to China, to Sichuan province, and to Hong Kong. And when we went to Hong Kong, I said, "Wow, we should go check out Macau, because this is a place that I've been interested in for years, and I've been, you know, casually researching." And, you know, again, the cuisine of Macau, what we found there was a combination of our own cultures and
right.
a combination of
Isn't
our own interests.
Perfect? I mean, it's so perfect, it's almost not real.
It is a very serendipitous story,
yes.
I will say.
Could I just mention that this book is so delightful on so many levels. Listeners, you're going to have to actually lay hands on it because we're not going to be able to cover all of this. I'm looking at the cover of the book, which has me hysterical. There's this Portuguese cock, whatever it is, the rooster, is it cock? Whatever.
The gallo, it is the rooster, the
yeah.
gallo de Barcelos.
I mean, I have yeah. a million of these. My mother used to bring all these back when she'd travel. She loved all these. And, anyhow, in fact, we have a friend who's a Portuguese chef, and he opened a little restaurant, and I gave him one of these in full color because his was black and white. I couldn't see it. And so I kept getting messages from his wife saying, "The cock is in the window." But okay, no, but it's being attacked by this angry clam. Tell me about this.
Well, I think, you know, for as far as the cover is concerned, you know, and we utilize this imagery to, as one, as signs for the restaurant, because we don't really necessarily have signs on the front of the restaurant. But I wanted to basically bring an element of humor, an element of fun into the restaurant, because the idea of Macanese cuisine and global Portuguese cuisine, this is a large topic that people don't necessarily understand. And at the end of the day, we really just wanted to have a fun place where people could just come and have a great meal.
But you have a serious mission. You have a whole section on your mission.
Absolutely. We do have a serious mission, but we want to be able to initiate people with some elements of fun, you know. And, you know, for the Galo de Barcelos, you know, the story behind him, I mean, he's been everywhere where the Portuguese have been. He's a symbol of honesty and integrity, and he kind of is fat rice, you know. He is the main character in which comes in contact with, you know, within the kind of comic illustrations, he kind of comes in contact.
Yes, this concept is the adventures of Fat Rice.
Right.
Maybe you should explain what Fat Rice is. We're probably losing
absolutely.
Them right now.
Well, it definitely has been an adventure. Fat Rice, the name comes from Arroz Gordo, which is the signature dish of the restaurant, but it's also a signature dish of the Macanese community. It's a home-style dish really reserved for family celebrations, large gatherings. It's a symbol of abundance and family. And we knew that when we opened the restaurant that we wanted to serve food that was big, large portions, satisfying, hot, all of these things. And Arroz Gordo really spoke to us because it incorporated many different elements of the world that culminated into Macau. It's essentially a rice dish. It literally means substantial rice. And we kept seeing in our books this translation, Arroz Gordo, fat rice, Arroz Gordo, fat rice. And there was something so simple about the name that stuck out where we could utilize that name as a great way for people to say, I've been to Fat Rice. I had a great meal at Fat Rice. You know, we didn't want it to be too inaccessible. We didn't want it to be Saffron and Lotus or something that was like or Caraval or Spice Root or something like that, that the thing easily could have been. So, you know, when we saw this beautiful paella-like dish of tomato-scented rice with chicken and pig's feet and sausages and raisins and, you know, and fried bread croutons. We said, this is going to be it. This is going to be the signature dish that's going to bring
you're
people
making
in
me
here.
So hungry. I'll tell you.
Now, hold on a second.
Back to the mission.
So this is a Macanese dish.
Yes.
Arroz Gordo is a Macanese dish.
It's not a Portuguese. It's not a Portuguese dish.
Well, that's the thing. Every Macanese dish is a little bit Portuguese.
Right.
So you know, it's definitely something that maybe started in the Iberian Peninsula, but it also has, you know, it also has relatives in India and in the Philippines. You know, and with the Arroz Gordo, again, it was a Macanese dish that really kind of exemplified what Macanese cuisine was and is, and I think which is a combination of Portuguese, Chinese, Malay, Indian. You know, you have all these ingredients from the New World, and so it really brought together all the elements that we wanted to convey and cook and talk about in the restaurant.
Sure.
And it was a simple enough name that it could translate really to anybody.
Yeah, it gives you a lot of room to integrate all these flavors into anything you make at the restaurant, huh?
Absolutely. You know, and I think in the beginning we said, you know, okay, we can kind of cook anything in between Portugal and Macau.
But did you narrow that? Because I'm talking about the mission again. I keep trying to get
absolutely.
Back on that.
So the mission has developed, I mean, and developed shortly thereafter the restaurant opened. you know, because we did have knowledge of Indian cuisine and Chinese, various regional Chinese cuisines, and those things were definitely on the menu. But I think as the word Macanese restaurant started, people started talking about it in articles and stuff like that, I said to myself, and I said to Adrian, I said, we need to really focus in on this and, you know, not, because we don't want to confuse people. We want to be able to say that this is a Macanese dish, this is a Portuguese dish, this is a Eurasian dish. And moving forward, the kind of mission now is not only to explore Macanese cuisine and the elements that make it up, but also to explore the other cuisines that have made up Macanese cuisine, because not only are the people, the Macanese people of Macau, utilizing their cuisine as a form of cultural preservation, there are also other communities in Malacca, Malaysia, in Goa, India, in Timor, East Timor, in Indonesia, that are also have this Portuguese lineage that then that's their form of identity, and they are utilizing their various recipes in these places to as a means of cultural preservation. And, you know, we want to explore all of those and to so that we can understand the impact and just kind of the overall global Portuguese cuisine, because you think of like, oh, well, what is the cuisine of Portugal? This is something that has been made up of ingredients and techniques from Brazil, from Africa, from India, from Asia, all of these things coming together.
As long as you have baklava, Portuguese.
my bacalao.
As long as you have bacalao, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. That is one big thread that goes through everywhere. Everybody loves.
We understand.
My mother brought me back a cookbook from Portugal. And there was, I swear, a bacalao recipe on every page.
Well, there are 300.
It said they have over 1,000 recipes for bacalhau, and the Portuguese are said to. But, you know, even in the book, we have one more that maybe the Macanese thought of that the Portuguese didn't, and that's called chichini de bacalhau, and it's essentially a derivative of the word chutney, but it's a dry-fried salt cod that becomes like fluffy and stringy and crispy, that is usually used to garnish like plain white rice or even to put on bread. And in our book, we do it over a relatively neutral tofu salad, which really allows the turmeric and the garlic and the chilies and the coconut milk in the chichini to really shine through.
Now, if people were a little bit hesitant about being able to use this, I thought you walked through the equipment and techniques very nicely, and you have discussions of ingredients. You have a glossary for ingredients. I was fascinated by the section on pickles and preserves. I didn't realize. I mean, does that go back like to the Japanese? I mean, they have so many pickles.
Absolutely. Well, I think pickles were kind of a big thing for us in the beginning, achars and pickles, because, you know, again, we want to look back, not just the past 100 years, not the last 200 years, but even before that, and what were people doing as a means of preservation before refrigeration, and salting, and using various techniques to preserve vegetables and fish and fruits, whether that was salt or sugar, was really important for us to understand, because you have a lot of flavor development that happens there. But it's also of historic significance, you know.
I like your little, what do you call those, the head notes on your thing, like on Charlie's Peanuts. You tell us a little bit about Adrienne's background. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, you know, and not only are we looking at Macau and other Eurasian communities, we are also, you know, this is our restaurant. This is a personal story. So there are definitely our own family recipes, Charlie being Adrian's father, and Adrian growing up eating what we call Charlie's Peanuts with Shifan, which is a congee of sorts. And, you know, and it was important for us to bring some of our own heritage recipes into the book. You know, we have Charlie's Peanuts, we have the Lowe family pot sticker recipes, we have my great-grandmother's Bacalhau salt cod recipe that I grew up eating around Christmas time. And so, again, not only is it a way for us to explore other people's cuisine, but also a way for us to explore our own cultures and share our own stories.
Well, I'll tell you, if people are getting bored with their general repertoire, this is the book to get. I mean, I've never seen... I love this baked pork chop rice thing with cookie-coated... You know?
Cookie-coated baked pork chop rice. That is an amazing, amazing dish. You know, it's decadent and kind of over the top in the best way possible. You know, and that pork chop rice, you see various iterations of that around Macau. That is definitely a newly created dish that you find in some of the restaurants and the diner-style restaurants called Cha Chun Tangs or tea restaurants. And, yeah, I mean, that's developed in the early 20th century, and you know, it's almost like the Chinese or Macanese version of, say, like an eggplant or a chicken parmesan or a veal parmesan or something, where instead of pasta, there's the stir-fried rice on the bottom and then the fried coated pork chop. Not everybody uses the Maria cookie crumbs. Some people use breadcrumbs. Some people don't use breadcrumbs. Some people don't use anything, but usually coated with and then topped with either a tomato sauce, sometimes a curry sauce, sometimes even like a bechamel sauce, and then broiled. And it's this really nice contrast between the fried rice.
And everybody
the sauce
will get
and
a
meat.
Tickle out of the cartoon instructions and your little
Absolutely.
Comments like have a cardiologist on speed dial.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
and we wanted to have fun. We wanted to have fun with it, and we wanted to, you know, again, keep it light, and really, you know, Sarah Beacon did an amazing job with the illustrations, and she's
that?
Somebody that Sarah Beacon is the illustrator.
Okay, very
and
good.
She's very good, and she's been with us and working with us almost 2 weeks after the restaurant opened. You know, she came in and she drew a picture of one of our dishes and posted it on her blog and said, I went to this new great restaurant. It had all these influences. It was really delicious. And then she tagged us on Twitter, and I said, we need to work together because you are the person that I've been looking for to kind of
She's
illustrate
perfect.
my ideas. And yes, so we really took the time to, especially with the instructive illustrations, to be clear so people could actually use the stuff at home. The one really great thing is what we call wok comics, where, because wok cookery can be so fast and over high heat usually, and it's easy with the wok comic to have a quick reference point and said, okay, add the garlic, then add the celery, then add this, and then add this. It's hard if you're cooking and trying to read at the same time, so we wanted to offer that easy visual contrast, that easy visual reference point that people could jump back to.
So now I understand why you did that. That's great.
Now, all of you listeners here in the United States, please know you are very fortunate because Fat Duck is in Chicago.
Fat rice.
I mean, a whole
fat
lot.
Fat Duck's in Bray, isn't it?
It's a whole lot closer than Macau.
Yeah, but now all of you people in Macau go out and eat because this is like a whole new cuisine, isn't it?
Well, the interesting thing is about the food of Macau. You have, and this is kind of an important thing to understand, is you have foods from Macau. Foods that Macau is famous for. These are things like the pork chop rice.
Yeah.
These are things like a dish called Portuguese chicken or Galinha Africana, also known as African
chicken. Yeah, that's funny. That was funny. I mean, that was an odd name. But my point is they should go out and eat because you said a lot of these recipes are in danger of being lost.
Well, that's part of the problem.
Single-handedly, if Fat Rice are going to preserve these here at least.
Well, and I'm hoping to be a part of it. You know, I want our friends in Macau to feel good about this book. And, you know, obviously we offer our own interpretations of some of these dishes, but I hope this will start a general dialogue, not only about Macanese cuisine, but also about other other cultures to preserve their own traditions and their own cuisines. Because the thing about it, even in Macau, you can't necessarily, there are dishes in this book that you can't necessarily go out to the restaurant and eat. I mean, lots of these dishes are from the home and are really specific. And what was my genuine interest in Macau and in Macanese cuisine was that these recipes are not cooked in restaurants. Some of the recipes were never written down. They're passed down through oral, these are oral traditions, you know, and it's important to understand that, yeah, like you can't just go out to the restaurant and eat taco or balichang tamarindo. I mean, there's literally only three restaurants that we go to when we go to Macau that really serve the dishes, that really serve the dishes that we're interested in.
Well, I can't wait to come to Fat Rice and taste these things. I mean, I'm really craving them right now. And I think everybody should get this book, The Adventures of Fat Rice. It's certainly going to be a change of pace from the run-of-the-mill cookbook, of which we get dozens and dozens and dozens. This one is exceptional. And thank you, Abraham Conlon, for talking to us.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Yes, and hello to Adrian.
Fat Rice sounds like really good stuff.
It sounds good to me. Well, we're going to hit that up with the James Beards when we're there.
We'll be in Chicago in May, I guess.
Yep.
So if we're not there before, then we'll certainly be sure to have Fat Rice in the Chicago end of the equation then. And you should too, and you should buy this lovely book.
Yes.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next guest is, by, I would say, all standards, a revered writer.
Revered, there you go.
Yeah, a revered writer, food writer, and teacher in her sphere of interest and research and experiences in Chinese cooking. And that's a vast place.
not too far from Macau.
Not too far from Macau. And here's a rather odd connection here to the Midwest, too, because when we talked to her, she was where? Nebraska.
She was in Kansas.
In Kansas. And she's English, and she's an expert on this particular.
Go figure if you can.
Yeah, well, you probably anyhow, the name you of the book by, is The Land of Fish and Rice.
Yeah, let's get on with it. we want to hear what she says, not what we say. So here she is.
Fuchsia Dunlop does not sound like the name of an expert in regional Chinese cuisine. In fact, it's Chinese cuisine in general, isn't it, Fuchsia?
Oh, well, I mean, I have written books about now three particular regional cuisines that I'm interested in researching in food all over China.
Yeah, well, we had every grain of rice when it came out, and that was a winner, wasn't it?
Did you enjoy cooking from it?
I didn't cook from it.
and Peter and I didn't cook from it either.
But it was a winner of a cookbook.
Yeah, we used to open it up and put it on the table and drink a glass of wine and say, now we've had dinner, we're not hungry anymore.
I've never been able to cook Chinese food. And one of the things that I really appreciated in your book here that we're talking about, which is called Land of Fish and Rice, which is subtitled Recipes from the Culinary Heart of China, which you expand on in that region near or around Shanghai. When I started trying to cook Chinese food, I got some cookbooks. This was early on back in the day. And they all had the same ingredients. I mean, I didn't know how you could make anything taste differently. What was it? It was soy sauce, garlic, ginger, and something else. I mean, and then you had Chinese food. But you get into the most interesting list of ingredients, and you actually spell them out in a section in your introduction. Unusual ingredients in this section of China, huh?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I want to introduce some new flavors and ingredients to readers. And I think that, yeah, people want to know about how to find them in a Chinese supermarket, what they look like, what they taste like, and what to do with them.
Right. And I said not every one of them is something that was in those early Chinese cookbooks that had just about five basic ingredients. I guess that was just
no, but I think the whole landscape has changed so much because, I mean, it used to be that it was very, very difficult to get specialist Chinese ingredients. But now I think so many places now have their own Chinese supermarkets. And then, you know, there are more Chinese people living abroad in American cities.
Oh, yes.
And so the range of ingredients that you can easily get in any Chinese supermarket is just expanding all the time.
Now, we should quickly point out, listeners, that you probably guess by now that Fuchsia doesn't actually belong in the United States, but she's talking to us today from Kansas, but she actually lives in London, and but you've seen the Chinese cooking scene in both countries, I guess, and probably a number of others as well.
Yes, yeah, and it's very interesting, and I think that in both Britain and the United States, what people think of as Chinese food for a long time was completely dominated by the southern Cantonese style.
Oh, yes.
Which is like, you know, what helped to create the Chinese food that we all sort of know and love. But actually that's just one part of China and one version of Chinese food. And what's happened in both countries in recent years is that there's been a real regionalization of Chinese flavors. And as you've got sort of growing Chinese communities of people, not just from Hong Kong and the Cantonese South, but from all over China, they are being catered for with more sort of authentic regional restaurants. So Sichuanese cooking is now tremendously popular. You can also find often the flavors of Hunan and of the Dongbei or northeastern China. So it's far more interesting and varied than simply Cantonese.
Right. Now, I didn't describe the area you're writing about precisely. Could you do that for our listeners?
Yes, well, it's the area just including Shanghai and the two inland provinces of Zhejiang and Jiangsu. And it's a region that's not very well known for its food in the West. But it's the headquarters of what people think of as one of the four great Chinese cuisines, which roughly correspond to the points of the compass. So in the south, the Cantonese, in the west, the Sichuanese, in the north, the wheat-based food of Beijing and Shandong province, and here in the east, the food of Shanghai, Zhejiang, Jiangsu provinces. And it's an ancient center of Chinese gastronomy with a long tradition of restaurants and of food writing and of the celebration of wonderful ingredients. And it's known really for its delicate flavors, for its beautiful ingredients, and also for red braising, which is that technique when you slow cook ingredients, particularly pork and fish, but with soy sauce and rice wine and sugar to create these sort of rich and gorgeous gravies which just soak deliciously into your rice.
Now, this is the area which is crossed by the Yangtze River, right? The great big
yes,
long river.
Well, it's known in Chinese as Jiangnan, or south of the river. So it's mainly the area south of the Yangtze, which divides China into two parts, roughly north and south.
Got it.
Now, this book I was talking to you about before, the Chinese cookbook by the couple named Chan, I think it listed seven or eight great cuisines of China.
Yeah, well, there are different ways of looking at it. So some people talk about four great regional cuisines. Some people talk about eight regional cuisines.
That's
Other
it.
People will talk about the cuisines of individual provinces or cities. So I think there are lots of different ways of looking at it, but the important thing to recognize is just that China is huge and very diverse in culinary terms. And the differences between, you know, food in one part of China, say in the north and somewhere in the far south, is even greater than the differences between different European countries and their food.
Well, you know, I read you have a section on the history of this region, and I got a yearning to live in the golden age of this region, which would be, you define it, 1127 to 1279 A.D., where, I mean, it sounds absolutely magnificent.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the golden ages of food in this region, because I would say there have been several, but yeah, this was the Song Dynasty when the imperial court was defeated by barbarians in the north and fled south to Hangzhou, which is one of the most important cities in this region. And so this is 800 years ago we're talking, when Hangzhou was one of the richest and most cosmopolitan cities in the whole world.
Oh, it sounds
like China.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, and it had this glittering restaurant scene, lots of fantastic dishes, specialist restaurants serving just regional cuisines or just the Buddhist vegetarian cooking or food served on ice. Incredible.
Now, 100 flavor soup.
How do you know this? I mean, do you actually read and speak Chinese? I suppose you do.
Oh, I do read. Yeah, I read and I speak and I write Chinese, yes.
But it has to be a specific dialect, right?
I mean, well, written Chinese is the same, really, as standardized, more or less, across China.
Okay.
So the spoken languages are different. But people speak Mandarin Chinese in most parts of China, so you can get by on that.
You know,
we
occasionally get feedback on our radio show in Mandarin.
Which is very helpful.
Yes.
We know exactly what they're talking about. They say, I love that last guest you had on. What was their name again? Was it Mr. Huflung Dong? Who was it?
Now, you have a section on these ingredients, which I keep going back to, because the primary ingredients are very distinctive for this area we're talking about. What are some of the things you could not cook your recipes without?
Well, basic seasonings, soy sauce, rice vinegar, Shaoxing rice wine, and sesame oil is very useful, ginger and green onion or scallion. And, I mean, I would think those are really the most important ones.
Right. And, of course, pork is king, right?
Yeah, I mean, with fresh ingredients, pork is the favorite meat in this region, as it is in most parts of China. And the cooks of the Jiangnan, the lower Yangtze region around Shanghai, do make the most fantastic pork dishes, I think, anywhere in the world.
Well, Peter's going to try that one.
Oh, sure.
Yes.
Sure I am, absolutely.
I hope you'll be very grateful that you did.
No question about it. I'll have to find a couple of the slightly different ingredients. We have a chef and his wife coming to dinner a week from Sunday, and of course I said I can cook. I'm hoping you'll be polite and he won't say anything.
No.
Now
I'm hoping that the dish turns out wonderfully and that he will just like it anyway.
Now I had an interesting conversation. I mentioned before we came on the air, there's a really beautiful Chinese restaurant in Mayfair called Kai.
Yes.
And the last time we went over there to dinner, the owner, who's a very interesting young man, he's only like 40 years old or something like that, and he's built a tremendously successful restaurant. But this particular night, he said, we're doing something different. I'm trying to teach my chefs, my cooks, how to cook with first-class ingredients, things like loin lamb chops. And things that
dressing meat, particularly.
Well, because a green vegetable is a green vegetable. But the interesting thing was, he said, my cooks have never seen a piece of finely marbled steak. They've never seen a beautiful loin lamb chop before. So I'm trying to get them to change the way they cook to incorporate these ingredients on the menu, which I thought was a very interesting viewpoint.
Yeah, and it's very funny because while I think, the market for Chinese restaurants in America and Britain has not been about the finest ingredients.
No.
You know, it's a lot of people go to Chinese restaurants and don't expect to pay a lot of money.
Right,
they don't
right.
expect
got,
to pay
got it
as much
exactly,
as they
yes,
would
yes.
French. But I should say that in China, and particularly in this Jiangnan region, historically and today, people who care about food are incredibly concerned with their ingredients. And there's a long tradition in China and in this region of being obsessed with having, for example, the special crabs of Suzhou and eating them only when they're perfect
in the fall season. Yeah.
You know, of eating vegetables when they're just right in exactly the month when they're at their most perfect. So these kind of values that we maybe think of as being more like modern Californian values.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you have you stated that all these things that characterized this particular region, the cooking of this region, and you could have been using the same terms to describe contemporary American cooking, including this love of fermentation.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, a lot of things that we don't necessarily see in the ordinary Chinese restaurant food abroad, you know, are very much part of, you know, China is a country with a serious tradition of gastronomy, and people there really care about food.
Right. You can't ask, but I sort of will. If you could pick out just several of your favorite recipes from this book to sort of point the listeners to those.
Well, I think the Shanghai red braised pork we've already discussed, really easy, fantastically delicious. I also love some of the vegetable dishes, and there's one in there for Chinese cabbage with a little salt pork, which is wonderful. There's also a noodle recipe that I make all the time at home.
Which one's that?
It's the Shanghai noodles with dried shrimp and spring onion oil.
Oh, yes, I saw that.
Only handful, I mean, four ingredients, I think, plus the noodles. It's terribly easy to make and is just delicious. You can never believe that something so simple could taste so spectacular.
But you have to get a hold of the right dried shrimp because it's not common in the States.
Well, any Chinese supermarket should have them. So you might not get them in your mainstream supermarket, but any Chinese store should be able to help there.
Right. And the desserts are not a main feature of this region.
No, I mean, in China, you don't have a dessert course with every meal, and most people would just eat fruit after a meal. So what we think of as dessert, as sweet dishes, tend to be served as snacks, you know, between meals or on special occasions. So there are some wonderful sweet dishes, like the deep-fried sweet potato cakes stuffed with red bean paste, but they don't loom as large in the cuisine as they would in, say, American or French.
Right. Now, what is it that I always ask this? This is my boring question. What do people who would be cooking these things, what do they drink with their special Chinese beautiful meal? Do they drink rice wine, or do they drink beer, or do they drink water? What's the tipple that goes along?
Well, some people in China would simply have a nice refreshing soup and not really drink anything specific.
Okay.
Other people would drink a beer. A light beer can be very nice. If you'd like to drink wine, Western wine, then I would go for quite clean, non-oaky white wines. Can be very lovely.
Right, right.
And then there is also Shaoxing wine. And if you want to drink Shaoxing rice wine, then just take care that you don't get one of the very cheap cooking wines, which sometimes have salt added and other ingredients, and they're not really intended for drinking. Make sure you get a drinking wine. And it's about the sort of same strength as sherry. It's that kind of drink, but that kind of strength of drink. So that's one option too.
Now, we have a very good Sichuan restaurant here in Pittsburgh, and we went there with a group. And so we took wine, and we had wine that had a little sparkle with it.
We needed to have cheap beer. Cheap beer is what
They bought. So some people bought cheap beer, and I bought not exactly cheap wine. And the little bit of sparkle that's in like a very fresh Sauvignon Blanc or something like that seemed to go down very well. So everybody else left educated, I think. And I like to think I did some of the educating.
Yeah.
You know what else we should talk about is that there's a long tradition of Buddhist vegetarian cooking in this region. And the thing that startled me was that they're into faux foods is what I call them. I had a vegan cousin who always insisted, like for Thanksgiving, to have tofu that looked like pieces of turkey, and I object to that. Why do they do that?
Now this wasn't FIFA. Yeah. That wasn't FIFO FIFUM. This is
well, in China, you know, in China, it's part of the fun and the playfulness of cooking. So not only in Buddhist vegetarian cooking, but in other styles of meat cooking. Chinese cooks sometimes love to make one thing look like another, so it's like a kind of edible witticism, an edible joke. Uh-huh. With Buddhist vegetarian cooking, although Buddhist monks themselves, the people who live in the monasteries, live in very simple diet of tofu and vegetables and grains and so on, the larger monasteries have restaurants where they do go to great lengths to make vegetarian ingredients look like meat or fish or poultry. And it is astonishing. So one of the recipes in my book, for example, is of a stir-fried eel dish.
I saw that.
Eels. Yeah, they're made of dried shiitake mushrooms, and they really do look and somehow convince your palate that they taste a little bit like eels. This tradition, incidentally, goes back at least 800 years because people ate things like this in Hangzhou in that period.
I see. Oh, boy. Well, you have such a wealth of information, Fuchsia Dunlop. I mean, what's your next book?
Oh, I've got a number of book projects simmering away on a back burner.
Well, anyhow, good luck with your book tour and success with this wonderful cookbook. And mentioning also that you have expert photography that certainly makes people eager to cook the stuff. And good luck. Much success.
Thank you very much. Great talking to you today.
Thank you, Fuchsia. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And wrapping up this week's program, we have what may be the most definitive book that I've ever seen in English on Chinese cooking, simply China, the Cookbook.
Hold on a second. It's not only is it the biggest book about China, it's the biggest cookbook there is.
I think maybe.
The print's really small.
But anyhow, the authors are Lum Chan and his wife, Diora Fong Chan, and Fiden published this book. And boy, they don't skimp on, this is one elegant book it has.
Yeah, but the absolutely amazing thing is I have no idea how they managed to even think of all this stuff, never mind write it down.
Well, this is what they do. This is their expertise.
But they retired. They were doing something else altogether. They retired.
Well,
and they
know
a lot,
and you will too if you read this book. I am so impressed. I need to get across to the listeners what a spectacular achievement this is. Kilam Chan, you and your wife, Diora Fong Chan, wrote this book called simply China, and it's encyclopedic, I think, or biblical maybe even.
It's like it when you hold it in your head.
Oh, it's very heavy, and it's very elegant, too. It's a Fiden production, and it has a gold-edged pages, and it's just amazing.
Just to give you an idea, listeners, if you've been into big cookbooks, then you know John Fawcett's cookbook probably weighs into the scales somewhere between 8 and 10 pounds.
This
is a rival.
Well, this one isn't quite so bad.
This is a rival. It's a big book.
Well, it's packed with information, and when we were chatting before, Kilam, you said that it only took like a year and a half or so to actually write it, but it was sort of a lifetime study of the subject. And I believe that because there's so much information and it's organized so lucidly. I mean, you should be congratulated on this achievement.
Thank you very much. And a lot to Fiden's credit also. Because they have a great editorial.
Well, it's a treatise on history and culture and food. Is that a good way of describing it?
Yes, I would say so.
Right, and you delve into the essence and history of the food, but you also present the differences between the different regions of China, the regional foods. And I remember when I was in graduate school that the colleagues of mine who were studying Chinese art found the diversity so amazing from one province to the next. But the country is huge, right?
Yes, it's a big country. A bit like the United States, big.
The only thing is, the difference is that while the United States has 350 million people, China has 1.4 billion or thereabouts. And it's probably 100,000 more since I started that conversation.
But it has a way deeper history, too.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
There's no question
and
about
the culture, that. The culture is just, but at any rate, you're tackling here now a country which you even admit should probably be viewed more as a continent than a country, with 34 provinces and regions and 56 indigenous nationalities, each with their own food traditions. That's pretty amazing.
Well, it is sort of amazing because of the diversity that we have to face with.
Well,
and I'm glad we got it done.
Well, yeah, I bet you're
Here's a question. Whose idea was it, and how many times did the other one of you say never?
Well, it was Sidon's idea to do a book on China. Of course, they're doing a series of national cuisine, and one for each country. So they approached us to write a book about China. And they said, why didn't you write about the 8 regional cuisines and plus maybe a few others? So when we thought about it, we say, if you put the name China on the book, it's got to cover the entire country, not uh-huh. just a few regions. So we decided to go one step further and say, well, let's do the whole thing, all 33 of them. And, well, initially, I have to say, we had some reservations because of the what they expect in terms of volume and the amount of time they gave us. They said, I need all the recipes within 12 months. So we said, well, you know, we had to say no a couple of times because we said, you know, we already have some commitments on hand at the time. We said, well, I don't think, you know, there are 800 recipes is too much, and 12 months is just too little, too much and too little. And we said, well, no. But then finally we so relented. We said, well, it's probably a very good idea to have China, the entire country, represented by a book on the international market. Uh-huh. Because very few people know about Chinese food beyond just, you know, the Cantonese food or Sichuanese food.
Yeah, that's it. States. I know. That's what all the early Chinese restaurants featured in the United States.
Right. And we have so much to offer. So I said, well, and I would like to write it for the home cooks. Not just restaurants, but home cooks. Because uh-huh. I think they can do it, and it's not all that difficult. There's always some mystery about Chinese cooking, how difficult it is. And I would like to dispel that mystery with this book.
So you think I can cook these recipes?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Now, here's my question. Why did Fidon select you to do this project? I must confess to not having dug quite as deeply into the book as Anne has. So I'm not sure if you're a teacher of cooking or you're a chef. You're a chef or you're a restaurateur?
Good question. First of all, we are not chefs, okay? I have my career in IT technology, and my wife has a career in terms of steel structure engineering, okay? But we have a family tradition in food and cooking, and my father was a gourmet and connoisseur and a writer as well. So it is in the family. Now, after we retired from our respective businesses, we retired, and one of the publishers in Hong Kong approached us and said, why don't you write down what you know? Because they know us and they know our families. So we said, fine. We started to write our first cookbook in 2010. And since then, we had published 15 cookbooks prior to Fidon approaching us. I think they approached us partly based on recommendations from Beijing. I believe Fidon had been looking around for some people to uh-huh. write this book. But it's difficult because they have certain requirements. So first of all, they have to write across the country, multiple regions. They need somebody who not just knows how to cook it, but can write about it. And thirdly, they want somebody to write it in the English language and not as a translation.
Right.
And fourthly, of course, the timing is very critical. They have very short time. So based on recommendation from Beijing, and we exchanged cookbooks with Fidon. They sent us theirs, they sent them ours, and I think they tested out some of our recipes, and they found it to be satisfactory, so they invited us to write the cookbook. So that's why how we ended up doing the project.
So you retired, and now you wonder how you ever had time to have a real job. It happens to us quite often. We sort of pretended we retired.
You know, you kind of start in like a lot of cookbooks do. You explain your subject, and then you explain the differences in cuisines of all these different provinces and territories. Then you do cooking techniques. Traditions, how you can expect to, how many dishes to serve, and the custom of dining with other people, entertaining. And you have a very clear explanation of all the different ingredients so that, you know, people are not going to be stuck. They're going to know what they're doing. And then you launch into this, what is kind of a standard cookbook approach with appetizers and soups and different meat, poultry, and vegetables, desserts. But each one now, all these recipes, you identify the region it's from, and you go all over the country. And the timing, it's also practical that I believe you, I probably could make one of these dishes.
Well, I would say start with scrambled eggs and shrimp. I always do that.
Yeah, that's a good one.
American home has eggs.
I was gonna suggest you start with boiled rice.
No. Actually, it's better to start with scrambled eggs. Forget about the shrimps for a moment. You don't need it. Just do scrambled egg the way I have it in the book, and I guarantee that you will like it. It is different from the American style, and it's you have eggs that are soft, smooth, and fluffy, and just full of flavor.
Now, somebody told us, like more than one person in the last couple of years has told us, there was a dish which Chairman Mao used to eat every day.
Uh-huh.
And it was some kind of pork with some kind of spicy red sauce.
It's in the book.
but which one? What's it called? Because we couldn't figure it out.
You can figure. Let me see. How did they name that one? Let me see. Let me ask Biden, because the reason why I hesitate, because of course I know in Chinese, but sometimes you change the name so that people can recognize it in the West. Chinese have a funny way of naming our dishes. And I need to... Oh, hold it. I have it. It is... No, not this one. The Hunan, the pork. Let me look a little bit. Look on the pork. Yeah, that's also one of my favorite dishes, by the way. I think that's also...
you like it, too.
The Biden tested it out. No. The Biden actually tested out this particular dish. Let me see. On the pork.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, we had it somewhere, didn't we?
I can't remember where.
We had it somewhere, and whoever.
Let me go down. I don't have my glasses, unfortunately.
Oh, dear.
Because the printing is rather small on the index. Hunan style pork belly in page 379.
379. Okay, thank you.
That's the one Chairman Mao likes, and that's the one that I think the editor and Biden did from our previous cookbooks, and she liked it.
There you go.
Okay, that's the Hunan-style pork belly. Well, nothing could be wrong with that.
Now, where do you live now? You talked about Hong Kong. Do you still live in Hong Kong?
Yes, we live in Hong Kong, and this gives us great, it's easy to get into China, various provinces and so on. So we found it very, very convenient.
Now, we looked at the chefs that towards the end of the book, you have these wonderful recipes and stories of some of the chefs around the world that you respect the most.
Is that how you selected them? I didn't know how you selected them.
Well, actually, I didn't. Actually, Fiden selected them. They're well-known chefs.
Yeah, I mean, we know some of these chefs. I mean,
Well,
no, I wanted to tell him about those people in Manchester, the sisters in Manchester.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh.
The restaurant is called Sweet Mandarin. It's in Manchester, England.
Manchester, huh?
And it's run by two sisters, Lisa and Helen Their last name is T-S-E. But the important part of the story is that when the Premier of China came to England for a visit with the Prime Minister, they invited these two sisters to come to 10 Downing Street to cook dinner for the Premier of China.
We have on our website
we have a photograph of them.
We have a picture of them together with the Premier.
Under OTM and photos.
Yes, at 10 Downing Street. But I thought that was really special. The fascinating part of the story is that their grandmother started the very first Chinese restaurant in Manchester in 1950.
Oh, wow. And somehow or other,
and there are some dirty work in the background here, she lost control of her restaurant. Somebody managed to get it away from her, and her nieces started it up again just like 15 years ago. I thought it was a very interesting story. And if you want to get in touch with them, you can find them through their website, I'm sure, sweetmandarin.com. But if you have any difficulty, send us an email or call us, and we'll make the connection for you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
When I said we know some of these chefs, Anthony, is it Louis? The Flower Drum. We've eaten at Flower Drum.
In Melbourne.
In Melbourne.
Yeah, we lived in Melbourne. Yeah,
at the time it was like number one in Australia's best restaurant.
The night we were there, the champion tennis players from the Australian Open tennis tournament, which had just concluded, were having a private dinner in the back.
Oh.
Where we were in front. It's a very big restaurant, if you're...
Flower Drum. Yeah. Well, we will be visiting Melbourne and Sydney, and I think one of the events we will have is at the Flower Drum.
Well, it's an excellent restaurant. There's no question about it.
I was surprised that the woman chef isn't in there. Kwang.
Kwang, uh-huh. Isn't it Kwang?
Kwang. Kwang.
Billy Kwang.
She.
I think it's Billy Kwang is the name of the restaurant, but that's not her first name.
No. What is her first name? No.
I don't know.
She is a cookbook, anyhow.
Yes.
Kylie.
Kwang. I know the name. So, I've seen her on TV.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I think she's more of a TV personality than she is a chef.
Well, let me point out, by the way, that leafing through this book, you're going to learn a lot about Chinese culture. I mean, that's something that I think is very important. And also, any of your favorite Chinese dishes that you've had, even if it's in America, you'll find a recipe here, probably more authentic. But I mean, you've got your rolls, and you've got your hot and sour soup, and you've got all that. I had a question.
I didn't include the chop suey, by the way.
That's my question. What is that? Why?
Chop suey?
I thought that was an American dish.
Well, it is a Chinese dish invented in America.
Okay.
On one of the visits by the Prime Minister of the Qing Dynasty in the 19th century. He came here as an ambassador to Washington. And I think he was doing one of his banquets or whatever, one of those events, that his cooks apparently put quite a number of various ingredients together on the same dish and presented it. And people liked it, and they say, what is it? And I think the cooks say, oh, it's chop suey. Chop suey actually means putting many things together. So, but the name chop suey is sort of stick. Okay, now, the Prime Minister Li was a resident of the Anhui province. So the province sort of honored him, and they included this American-style Chinese dish into as part of their cuisine, Anhui cuisine. But however, it is still an American-Chinese dish, and that dish, unfortunately, is not served in China, I have to say. But they included a recipe of chop suey as part of their cuisine, Chinese cuisine. So I would say it is genuinely Chinese cuisine, even though it is made in America.
Now, you say that you don't have a recipe for Peking duck, I guess. If you want Peking duck, go to Chinatown.
Go to a little restaurant. You're not going to cook that.
You can go to Chinatown. You remember the last time we were in San Francisco, we were in Chinatown around like 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
And everybody picked them up.
And everybody's going to get their Peking duck and some sauce as well. So they go into the shop, grab a Peking duck, get a container of sauce, and then be off. And the next person. Sort of right. Like the soup Nazi in New York City.
Fast food Peking duck.
So, and you also have General Tso's chicken. That's often viewed as a joke, because it's so common and so Americanized.
Again, actually, I think it is really. It is not so much American dish. I believe the dish was invented in Taiwan, I think. And it was invented in Taiwan. Also, it really has nothing to do with General Tso, because it happened to be a dish with a lot of chili. And the general was known for his love of chili. So somehow or other, uh-huh. The name stuck. And eventually it got imported into America. And it's now sort of like an American dish, but it is genuinely Chinese dish.
You know, the spicy thing brings up. Now, I mean, we just got Peter and I happen to like the Sichuan food. I mean, it's, unless you accidentally actually bite into where those peppers, that finishes you. But now, that's what I've always understood was the characteristic of Sichuan cuisine, that spicy chili stuff. But chilies weren't introduced into China until the 16th century. So,
it was introduced probably a little bit earlier. I would say it was introduced about 1516. Actually, my guess, it was introduced in about the 15th century.
Okay.
Because that was when China sent out several envoys to Southeast Asia, all the way to Africa on 7 long boat trips, sea voyages. And I think that is when they brought back a lot of things. And chili was one of the ingredients that was brought back to eastern China and ultimately onto Sichuan. That was, I think, like in the 15th century. And then we're close, 15, 16, about thereabouts. So chili was sort of new to us.
Now, what's your verdict on whether or not Marco Polo introduced noodles to China, or whether Chinese noodles inspired the production of spaghetti. Which is it?
Well, I think we had noodles earlier than spaghetti.
Okay. I'm conceding to you that I think Chinese are responsible for noodles. I do.
Probably so.
So you have a number of noodle recipes, right?
Yes, quite a number, and from various areas, including from Sichuan, the Danban noodles, I think I have it in there.
Uh-huh. Now, tell me this. We interview people from Thailand and all over. I mean, do coconut palms grow everywhere in the world, or what? Coconut seems to be a very important ingredient, and you never see pictures of coconut palms in China. Where do they grow?
They grow on the Hainan Island on the south one, on the southernmost end of China. There's a big island, and the big island is also very close to the Vietnam and so on. So that area of the world, and a lot of coconut palms. So we get a lot of coconut from the Hainan Island.
Okay, all right. And you were starting to explain how noodles were invented. Do you want to finish that? What about these pulled ones?
Well, noodles, in China, the southern people eat rice, whereas northern people eat wheat. Okay, so the noodle is something that it's part of their tradition. Even if we go back a couple of 2,000-3,000 years ago, they were using wheat, and then they grind them into flour, and they make various kinds of things. they make things like a cake, something like a cake, like bread, for example, and they make something like noodles. Okay, those were in China for have been a very, very long time. So the northern people eat wheat-based cereals, and southern people eat rice-based cereals. And so noodles was something they've had for a long, long time. In some provinces, they eat nothing but noodles. They love noodles.
So much of everything in this book. Like, we interviewed somebody who wrote a whole book on Hakka-style cuisine or Hakka cuisine. And I didn't realize it was so pervasive throughout China.
It is. Actually, we had written a separate book on Hakka cuisine in Hong Kong. But there are a lot of Hakka people around the world. I think over 100 million.
Well, they're itinerants. It was an itinerant culture, wasn't it?
Sorry?
It was an itinerant culture. I mean, it spread.
Yes. Hakka is sort of interesting because they are not a separate ethnic group, and there's no province that is called Hakka.
No, that's
but
right.
There are a lot of Hakka people everywhere. They seem to be, you know, well, they go everywhere. And with them, their cuisine is very, very popular. With that, you know, spread, you know, particularly more in Southeast Asian part to start off with, a lot of Hakka people and a lot of Hakka cuisine. And then they eventually, of course, move elsewhere in North America and parts of Europe. So they are one of our largest group, cultural, I would say, group, which doesn't have a home base.
You know,
the food is extremely good.
That's what I hear. Now, there was one cuisine I was reading about that where, I can't remember, it's religion-based, I can't remember, where garlic
Buddhist.
The garlic, because there were a couple other items that they were strong smelling, and therefore they interfered with meditation.
Yes, yes.
It's amazing. I never thought of it.
Yes. Buddhism was introduced to China, I think, around the 4th or 5th century. Okay, and they had also a great influence on Chinese cuisine because they would have many followers. And they, of course, would stick very, very close to the vegetarian dishes.
Right.
Even though not everybody is a monk, but even the non-monk people would follow that, and they would follow the way of cooking. And purely vegetarian, again, you know, because people meditate together in a group, and they don't want people to interfere with each other, you know, by eating the wrong kind of food.
I see.
So that is why they're very, very strict. And that is very unique to Chinese Buddhism, because you don't find the same thing in Tibetan or in Japanese Buddhism or in other parts of the world. Chinese Buddhism is very, very strict on what you can and cannot use in the food.
Well, that was news to me, too, actually. So much is news, and so much you can learn from this book. Listeners, you need to... It also helps with physical stamina and strength if you lift this cookbook around. it's such a delight to see it, the good photographs of it, the food styling, everything is just super about it, Keelan. And congratulations to you and Diora. And I think you're living in probably one of the best food sites in the world, Hong Kong.
Yes, I have to agree. We've got everything. And
you
they
do.
Come in. Very, very nice.
Well, have a good rest of your book tour, and thank you for talking to us.
Thank you very much. And it's so nice to be on your show.
Well, I enjoyed it thoroughly. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
So there you have it. And a Far Eastern...
Yeah, but I feel so well schooled in Far Eastern cuisine.
But with a British and a Chicago connection, what could be wrong with that?
Not to mention this poor woman stuck in Kansas. Sorry, all you Kansas people. I used to live there too.
Yeah,
I had a good time. Leland.
There you go, Leawood, Kansas.
Leawood.
You weren't out where she was. She was out in the sticks somewhere.
Yeah. Anyhow, what lovely books are coming out. This is the time of the year for it, so you can.
So be sure
study up and fill everybody's stockings. This one would not fit into a stocking.
Yeah, so be sure to tune in Same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.